Thanks for the opportunity to speak here. What I'm going to be talking about today is about relationship of bulk and boundary properties of something called symmetry-protected topological phases. And in a moment, I'll try to define some terminology. I should say this work was done in collaboration with Chenji Wang, who's here at Perimeter Institute, and Chen-Hung Lin, who's now he's at University of Alberta. Okay, so since this conference has people coming from a number of different backgrounds, I thought I should spend a couple slides just defining some terminology. So what are the objects we're going to study in this talk, and maybe more generally, I think, in other talks also. So I think the main object that I'm going to be talking about, and probably most people are going to be talking about, is the notion of a quantum many-body system. And so the idea here is that you can, the sort of classic example is maybe a lattice spin system. So we have some lattice. Each one of these dots is supposed to be a spin or some local degree of freedom that can be in a number of different states. The Hilbert space for this system can be thought of as a tensor product of local Hilbert spaces, where we have a sort of a local Hilbert space at each one of these sites. So if these were spins, this might be, let's say, a two-dimensional Hilbert space, for a spin could point up or point down on each site. So the total Hilbert space is going to be this tensor product kind of structure. And then we're going to be interested in a particular kind of Hamiltonian, which is basically a Hamiltonian with local interactions. So what that means is that the Hamiltonian is going to be a sum over, let's say, sites I of the lattice. And it's up in, for each site I, there'll be some operator Hi, which acts non-trivially on, say, sites within some distance, finite distance of I, and then acts like the identity on further sites that are further away. So this is sort of what I mean by local operator. It's something that acts just non-trivially on these sites and identity elsewhere. And the Hamiltonian will be some sum over all different sites. This, I should say, to be precise, I think the definition I've given here is really for bosonic systems, but with small modifications, this could also apply to systems made of electrons. So what we're interested in is studying this kind of quantum system with this tensor product Hilbert space and these local interactions. Now, there's sort of two, when you think about these quantum many-body systems, you can, the important thing you want to ask is about their energy spectrum. And there's sort of two possibilities for the energy spectrum in general. So if you take some finite chunk of this lattice, you can diagonalize the system, and there's sort of two possibilities. Either you find, let's say, a ground state or maybe some finite number of states separated by some gap from excited states, or you find kind of a whole sort of continuum spectrum like this. So if we're in this situation here where we find a finite gap separating the ground state from the excited states in the limit where our system size becomes arbitrarily large, then we will say our system is gapped. If we find that that there's no separation between the ground state and the excited states in this limit of arbitrary large systems, then we'll say it's gapless. And in this talk, and probably also in many of the talks in this conference, we'll be focusing on this class of many-body systems, systems with this energy gap. Okay, so now, you know, even when we restrict to quantum many-body systems with an energy gap, there's a whole huge number of possibilities. So it's useful to kind of organize them into classes of many-body systems that all share the same qualitative properties. So that brings us to the notion of a quantum phase. So the idea here is very similar to sort of phases you're familiar with. You know, if you look at the phase diagram of water, you have these three distinct kinds of qualitative behaviors. Well, actually, the liquid and gas phases are not so distinct, but let's forget about that for a second. You have these distinct types of qualitative behaviors, and it's useful to kind of say that all the different systems in this phase, they share some of the same qualitative properties. They're all rigid in the ice phase, and they're not rigid in the water phase, and so on. So it's useful to define a similar notion in this in our context, where we want to put Hamiltonians with the same qualitative properties in the same phase. So we define this notion of a phase in the following way. We'll say that two Hamiltonians belong to the same phase if they can be connected, if you can find some interpolating Hamiltonian, which interpolates between them, with the property that everywhere along this path, the energy gap remains open. And it turns out that this definition, if the energy gap remains open along this whole path, then you can kind of argue that these two Hamiltonians share many of the same qualitative properties. And in some sense, this is analogous to saying two points here belong to the same phase if you can get from one to the other without a phase transition. Okay, so now we have this notion of phases or equivalence classes of these classes of these Hamiltonians. But you know, it's still a very hard problem to think about, even trying to understand the different phases that can occur. So the next thing we want to do is kind of think about, try to break the problem down and think of some slightly simpler, some special cases that we can maybe make progress. So it turns out that it's kind of useful to think about two axes in thinking about different types of phases. So we can think about symmetries, and we can think about statistics of excitations. So in terms of symmetries, we can think about phases that have no symmetry at all. We can think about phases which have some kind of unitary symmetries, or we can think about phases that have anti-unitary symmetries. So the classic example would be, say, time reversal symmetry. And also, the other thing we can think about is some systems have excitations with fractional statistics. I'll say a little bit more about that later. And some systems have no excitations with fractional statistics. So that's another kind of useful axis to think about. And I've kind of organized these in level of difficulty. So thinking about phases with no symmetry is easier than thinking about phases with unitary symmetry. It seems to be anti-unitary symmetry is the hardest, for at least mathematically. And similarly, thinking about systems with no fractional statistics is easier than thinking about systems with fractional statistics. Sorry? Yeah, that's true. There's bosons and fermions, which is a third dimension. So anyway, so this is kind of the phase space of different possibilities we can think about. And to make progress, we kind of are often focused. Is there a question?
Fractional statistics are only in two
dimensions. Well, not really. It can also exist in three dimensions. I'll give an example. So that's statistics between a particle and a loop can occur in three dimensions. So, to make progress, we have to think about some special cases. So in this talk, I'm going to think about this case here, which is sort of different types of symmetries, but no fractional statistics. Okay, and just try to understand what are the properties of these systems. And in particular, as I said, I'm going to think about the relationship between bulk and boundary properties. Now, these kinds of phases, which kind of have no fractional statistics but different types of symmetries, we can call, roughly speaking, these are what we call SPT phases. But let me give you a precise definition of this, of these systems. So we'll say that if we have some gap quantum many-body system, we'll say it belongs to an SPT phase if it has several properties. So the first property is that it has some set of symmetries which commute with the Hamiltonian. Okay, so these. And these symmetries I'm going to think of as not as space-time, at least in this talk, they're not going to be like translational symmetries or space-time symmetries, but rather sort of symmetries that act on each site of the lattice, internal symmetries, like spin rotation. So it has some set of symmetries, and these symmetries are not broken. So the ground state is also invariant under these symmetries. The second property, which is a little bit more technical, is this idea that the ground state is short-range entangled. So that means, roughly speaking, is the ground state is very similar to a product state. More precisely, the ground state can be transformed into a product state, which is some tensor product state like this, by a local unitary transformation. And the local unitary transformation, I guess a precise definition, you could think of it as something generated by a local Hamiltonian, finite time evolution of some local Hamiltonian. So it kind of only scrambles degrees of freedom locally. And I should say that this second property here is kind of related to that no fractional statistics thing here. So you can show that anything which is short-range entangled doesn't have fractional statistics. So this is actually a little bit stronger than saying it has no fractional statistics. It's a stronger assumption. Okay, so this is the definition of SPT phases, but there's a very trivial example of an SPT phase, which is that you could have a Hamiltonian whose ground state is a product state. Obviously, that will obey this condition here. The U would just be the identity. And maybe it has some set of symmetries which commute with this, that leave this product state invariant. So that's a really trivial example, but here we're going to be interested in sort of non-trivial SPT phases. So we'll say an SPT phase is non-trivial if it's sort of distinct from a product state. Or more precisely, you can't smoothly connect your Hamiltonian to some other Hamiltonian, which has a product state, ground state, by some path without something going wrong. You know, you either the energy gap is going to close or you're going to have to break the symmetry somewhere in the path.
Could you clarify the relationship between Hamiltonians and states?
Yeah.
It feels like there were those states with trying to connect and here's the
Hamiltonians. Well, let's see. I mean, I'm not sure how I can answer your question without going into more detail. We often use them kind of synonymously because in many cases you can show that, I don't know if I want to get into that though. Let me see if you can be more specific about your question. So here I'm classifying Hamiltonians if you like, but one of the properties I'm using is that its ground state is short range entangled. I'm requiring its ground state. Different ground states for the same Hamiltonian. So I guess here for these systems, this is a unique ground state because there's no broken symmetries. And yeah, let's say unique ground state. Let's say when I say SPT phase, it has a unique ground state, which is short range entangled. Yeah. Sorry, maybe I should have said that. Does that answer your question? Okay, so it's non-trivial if it's somehow distinct from a product state. Okay, so what are some examples of these systems that are these non-trivial SPT phases? Well, a famous example, which has inspired probably the definition, is the topological insulators, which are some band insulators that exist in 2 and 3 dimensions, and they are the symmetries that the relevant symmetries are charge conservation, U1 symmetry, and time reversal symmetry. Another example is this so-called Haldane spin chain. So this is a one-dimensional system, and there the relevant symmetry is time reversal. In general, there are many, many other examples. You can think about different dimensions, and you can think about different symmetries, and there are many, many different SPT phases you can think about in each case. So now, why do we care about these phases? So I gave you some very abstract definition. I think physically, the reason we care about them, the reason they're interesting, is because they're boundaries. So if you consider, it's generally believed that if you take if you take a non-trivial SPT phase, and you define it in a geometry with a boundary, you find that on the boundary, you have gapless excitations, which are kind of robust in a way, which I'll explain in a second. So what I mean by that is that you have your Hamiltonian here, it has an energy gap, but if you define it in a geometry with a boundary, you find that under very general conditions, that there's always something gapless. Once you introduce a boundary, you get a gapless spectrum. And this gapless spectrum comes from excitations that live near the boundary. Now, I said under very general conditions, this system is gapless, so maybe I should be kind of precise, you know, how general. I'll do that in a second. But let me just say one more thing, which is that we say that these, because we have these very stable gapless excitations on the boundary, we say that they're kind of protected. Because these gapless excitations are here kind of independent of details of what you put on the boundary. Somehow, these gapless excitations are determined just by the bulk, the properties of the bulk. So that's why we call them protected. Now, I should give you a precise definition of what I mean by protected. So the notion of protected sort of depends on dimensionality. So I'm going to focus on the three-dimensional case because that's what I'm going to be talking about here. So what does it mean to say something has a protected surface? What do I mean by protected surface in the three-dimensional case? What I mean is that basically is the following statement, that the surface, you cannot make the surface, you can't have a gapped and symmetric surface unless you also, without also having the surface have excitations with fractional statistics. So in some sense, the claim is that typical 3D SPT phases, which are non-trivial, have the property you can't have a completely trivial boundary. You can't have a gapped symmetric boundary with no fractional statistics. It either has to be gapless, it has to break the symmetry, or it has to have fractional statistics on the boundary. So in that sense, it's kind of, one way to say it is, it'll be gapless under very general situation. The only way you can introduce a gap is if you break the symmetry or you introduce fractional statistics. Yeah. Right. So you're saying
the gapless one is the non-generic.
Right. Right.
And the fractional statistics is the more generic.
Right. So
it's not to say it's not harder.
Yeah. That may be historical to some extent because people, I think, initially didn't recognize there was this possibility. So they thought the surface cannot be both gapped and symmetric. In fact, that's what happens if you go one dimension down in two dimensions. And so they said, okay, well, if the symmetry isn't broken, it has to be gapless. But we now know there's this third possibility, fractional statistics. So you're right. You can have a generic surface which is gapped without and symmetric. Yeah.
What was the statement in 2 plus 1?
In 2 plus 1, the statement is that the surface cannot be both gapped and symmetric, period. Right. So, yeah, so why, I mean, I think the other reason people sort of say it's sort of protected gapless is they, you know, because people think of fractional statistics as very exotic. So they say, okay, in any real system, we're not going to have fractional statistics, and we're probably going to have the symmetry, so it's going to be gapless. Maybe that's another reason.
Do you have any sketch of an algorithm of why a non-trivial path
may mean? So that's part of the point of this talk, is to try to demonstrate that. So I, that's why I didn't say it's true. I just said it's believed to be true, or you know, we have some feeling. But here, part of the purpose of this talk is to try to really understand that. And okay, so that leads us to two main questions, which is, you know, this kind of protected surfaces are very interesting, so we'd like to understand them better. So there's sort of two questions we can ask. So suppose we have some Hamiltonian or some belonging to an SPT phase. First question we can ask is, how do we know whether this Hamiltonian has a protected surface? What are the bulk properties we should look at which will determine whether or not it has a protected surface? As I said, this protected surface is really coming from some structure in the bulk, so we should be able to read it out from the bulk Hamiltonian. So that's one question. Then we could go a step further if we were going to be more ambitious, and we could say, more detail, what's the relationship between the bulk and surface properties of these systems? If I know something about the bulk, what can I say about the surface? If I know something about the surface, what can I say about the bulk? And that's this notion of a bulk boundary correspondence. So we, in some these questions are in some sense asking, what is the bulk boundary correspondence for these systems? You know, maybe it's useful to draw an analogy with a sort of more familiar bulk boundary correspondence, at least in the condensed matter context. So there's a very sort of simple bulk boundary correspondence that's known for two-dimensional band insulators. So these are non-interacting fermion systems in two dimensions with charge conservation symmetry. And the correspondence is between the bulk quantity is something called the Hall conductivity, also sometimes called the Chern number. And it's something you can measure in the bulk. It just tells you if I apply an electric field, what's the perpendicular current that runs in response to that electric field. And that's the bulk quantity. Then the boundary quantity that you can ask about is you can ask about if you have these, in this case, the edge modes are gapless. You have a gapless edge. You can ask about the number of right-moving edge modes and the number of left-moving edge modes. So you can define two integers, nr and nl. And the bulk boundary correspondence says that the Hall conductivity is equal to nr minus nl in appropriate units. And so this relates some bulk quantity that is measurable locally in the bulk to some boundary quantity which is measurable in the boundary. And note also, it also answers our, it relates the two, I should also mention it answers the first question, which was how do we know, in this case, how do we know whether something is gapless, has a protected edge? Well, if sigma xy is non-zero, we know that if you look at this equation, it implies that either nr and l has to be non-zero. So in this case, the quantity you want to compute to tell whether the edge is protected is this sigma xy. So this formula really answers both questions in this context. And in some sense, what I want to do is try to derive a similar kind of formula in this three-dimensional case, which will answer both of those questions about the relationship between bulk and boundary. Okay, so in some sense, so that's sort of what I want to say here. Now, the particular bulk boundary correspondence I'm going to be thinking about is I have some 3D SPT phase, and I'm going to assume that the surface is gapped and symmetric. And I'm going to ask something, you know, I want to, in analogy with that example, I want to find some bulk data that describes the properties of the bulk, and I want to have some surface data that describes the properties of the surface, and then I want to derive some relationship between the two of them, which will be our bulk boundary correspondence. And okay, so Now, to do, you know, I'm going to focus on a simple case, so I'm not going to do this in complete generality. So in particular, I'm going to think about the case where I have those symmetries are unitary as opposed to anti-unitary symmetries. I'm also going to assume that they form an abelian group. And to make things really simple, I'm going to assume the group is of this form, Zn to the k. Although that's not so important. Actually, any abelian group, the same story will hold. Now, what about the surface? I'm going to assume that surface anions, remember, when it's gapped and symmetric, there has to be something, fractional statistics on the surface. So we have some anions on the surface. So I'm going to assume that those are abelian, and that they form, whenever you have abelian anions, you can always define a group, because you can fuse two anions together to make a third anion. That defines a product, a group multiplication. And so I'm going to assume that the group that they form is of the form Zn to the m. Again, that's not important. It could be a general abelian group, and the same story would hold. But for the symmetries, you mean?
Yeah.
So I think the same story would hold, although in three dimensions, we don't have any really good examples with just continuous symmetries, at least. They always have some discrete piece. Yeah, you could. I think the same story can be applied there. There's like slight technical issues, but I don't think it's so different. Right, so I'm assuming that it's unitary abelian and that we have abelian surface anions. I'm also going to assume that the symmetry does not permute the surface anion. So when you apply a symmetry operation, it doesn't change one anion into another, which is possible in general. And finally, I'm going to assume that it's built out of bosons. That's the case I'm going to be thinking about. So the first question we need to do is we need to find this bulk data and surface data that we're going to relate together, right? So how do we find this data? So there's kind of a general recipe for doing that, which is the following. So we're given some Hamiltonian with some unitary symmetries. So what we're going to do is basically, if you're given any Hamiltonian with unitary symmetries, what you can always do, I'm assuming these symmetries are kind of internal symmetries, you can always gauge these symmetries. And I won't describe exactly how that's done in detail, but that you can always take your Hamiltonian and couple it to a gauge field. So I won't describe exactly how that's defined in general, but there's a precise procedure from going from a Hamiltonian with unitary symmetries to a gauged Hamiltonian like this. So I call this Hamiltonian H gauge. So there's this, some very concrete procedure to go from H to H gauge. I'm going to make it dynamical connection. I don't think it's so important, but it makes things clearer, because now excitations I'm talking about will be true excitations of my system rather than some extrinsic defects. But since these are discrete symmetries, it doesn't, it actually doesn't matter that much, because the dynamics is kind of not very interesting. There's like a gap to these excitations. I'm sorry? If the symmetry is spontaneously broken, then yes, of course. But I should have said, when I said in my first slide, when I say SPT phases, the symmetries we always assume are unbroken.
Well, but now it can become SPT after the gauge. Because the different box you are now gauge equivalent.
I'm not sure I understand, sorry. I'm sorry?
My comment is probably close to the problem where you're heading.
Okay.
I just say one sentence. When we global symmetry is spontaneously broken, we have several ground states. When the same gauge symmetry is spontaneously broken, we don't get several ground states. Only one, because they all gauge copies.
Oh, you're saying you could get into a confining phase. You could, or a Higgs phase. Is that what you're talking about? Or a confining phase?
I don't like the terminology, but I like the spirit.
Okay. So I'm assuming
that. What I mean is that even if it wasn't SPT after gauging, it could become SPT.
Uh-huh. Okay.
It wasn't SPT because it had several ground states before the gauging.
I see. Okay, I'm assuming, I'm not starting with a system with several ground states. It's a unique ground state, sort of, let's say, by assumption.
So we're saying it's always possible to gauge a symmetry, but it could be anomalous, right? Like the symmetry could have.
No. I'm assuming these are symmetries that are defined on the lattice. So these are not anomalous. Okay. I have a very clear regularization. Okay.
So that's an important point, right? So since it's sort of a symmetry itself, you find a lattice.
Yeah.
Local, you cannot have any anomalies.
Yeah, there are no anomalies.
You cannot gauge anything.
Yeah. No. These are non-anomalous symmetries. These are local symmetries. They're defined on the sites on the lattice. So the general procedure is we take this Hamiltonian, then we can define a gauged Hamiltonian. Now, I told you that when we're talking about SPT phases, they don't have excitations with fractional statistics. That was kind of part of the definition. But when you gauge a Hamiltonian, you introduce new types of excitations. And those excitations do have fractional statistics in general. And so then you can ask about the braiding statistics of those excitations, and that defines some braiding data. And so now this gauge theory is going to have excitations on the surface, and it's going to have excitations in the bulk. And so by looking at excitations in the bulk, we're going to get our bulk data by thinking about their braiding statistics. And by looking at the excitations on the surface, we're going to get our surface data. Okay, so that's the general procedure. So let's sort of apply it in our case. So we're going to take our Hamiltonian with a symmetry, and we're going to gauge it. And we're going to then think about the excitations.
But this whole place, you said you want to look at the bulk property of the original phase, but now it's going to change your theory.
Well, so I think the point here is that it's actually not that different from the Hall conductivity, in the sense that the Hall conductivity is defined by you couple your system to a gauge field. It's a linear response. You couple the gauge field and you ask what the response is. So in some sense, we're doing the same thing. In fact, the data that I'm going to describe right now, the Hall conductivity is a special case of that. So it's a way of probing the structure. You couple it to a gauge field and then you ask, what are the statistics of these excitations? It's very similar to thinking about.
I think this discussion would be a lot clearer if the gauge theory you couple to is not dynamical at last.
So
this is all these issues will not arise. Mm-hmm. These are the questions. I think the question that the three of us asked are closely related.
Mm-hmm.
Even in the case of the whole system, you couple it to the U1, like magnitude, you should really be thinking
that U1 is being classical. Yeah, that's right. So there it's classical.
The analogy you gave it yet have to be justified.
Right. So you probably could think of these as a classical gauge field. The reason why I don't want to do that is because I really want to think of these as intrinsic excitations, that local excitations. It's easier for me to understand braiding local excitations. If I couple to a classical gauge field, then when I think about like a flux, it's going to have like a branch cut that's going to be attached
to it.
Even
when you braid local excitations, you need to do something to pin them and bring them around. Right? So effectively, you're creating a defect. That's one of them. So
right. Yeah. So I think that probably if it makes you feel any better, because I think you can define all these braiding statistics, at least in the abelian case, in the classical gauge field and with an external classical gauge field, and it would be basically the same story. You'd have to draw some slightly different pictures where instead of having an excitation, it has like a branch cut attached to it. So, you know, in two dimensions, I'm not going to do the 2D case, but I'd be talking about, you know, let's say taking one flux around another and ask what the braiding statistics is. What you would have to do is draw something like this. So this is a branch cut.
I don't think we need a branch cut, because this object exists without a branch cut. It does not depend on the choice of branch cut.
The branch cut won't play that important role, but in some sense, the Hamiltonian that you're talking about is modified along this entire line. You have to choose some line which is modified. Now, it's true that you could still probably define this phase and so on. So that's what I'm saying. You can probably do that story. But I don't like drawing these pictures. I like to think of them as local. So I think the claim I want to make is that all the data I'm talking about is, you can think of it, it would probably reproduce the data you're talking about here. But now I don't have to draw the pictures like this. Now, in the non-abelian case, gauging the symmetry is slightly different from thinking about a defect. But in the abelian case, they're basically identical. Okay, so let's think about the excitations after we gauge the system. So the first type of excitation we can have is a local excitation, a charge excitation. So these are excitations that basically came from the original model. If you have some excitation in your original model which has some transforms non-trivially under the symmetry, then when you gauge it, it acquires a gauge charge. It becomes something non-trivial. So these are point-like excitations. And in general, these charges, they're characterized by the amount of gauge charge they carry, which is a k-component vector, q1 through qk, where each component is an integer defined modulo n. And the reason it's defined modulo n is, remember, we're talking about a zn gauge field. So the other type of excitation we can have is a vortex loop. So this is the excitation where there's non-trivial gauge flux along this entire line. And these excitations are characterized by how much gauge flux they carry, which is also a k-component vector, which is and where each component is a multiple of 2 pi over n. And again, it's a multiple of 2 pi over n because these are Zn gauge fields. So this is the amount of gauge flux under the ith gauge, Zn gauge field. So these are the excitations you have in the bulk. Now, a key point is that, in general, vortex loops can also carry gauge charge. And the reason is that, you know, there's actually, you can always attach a gauge charge to a vortex loop, and that defines another type of loop-like excitation, which is actually topologically distinct. So that's an important point to keep in mind, is that there's multiple types of loops carrying the same gauge flux, and they differ by the amount of charge they carry. So those are the excitations in the bulk. What about in the boundary? So in the boundary, you can also have vortex lines, but now they can terminate at the surface. So that's so we have these sort of vortex line excitations. And these are characterized by their gauge flux, which is also a k-component vector, where each component is a multiple of 2 pi over n. Now, there's a final type of excitation you can have at the surface, which is, remember, even in the ungauged system, we have these surface anions. So when you gauge the system, these surface anions become a little bit more complicated, but you still have localized excitations on the surface. And they're characterized by, I'll call this, this is just a terminology, they're anionic flux, which is an m-component integer vector, where each component is an integer mod n. And what does this mean? Well, remember, in the ungauged system, we had our anion group was zn to the m. So that means that each anion could be characterized by an m-component vector that sort of tells you where, which can be labeled by that. And so it turns out, after you gauge them, you can still label your anions like this, although it's not a unique labeling. So multiple anions can carry the same anionic flux. OK, so those are the excitations. Now we need to think about their statistics. That's how we're going to derive the data. So let's think about the bulk first. So the first thing you can think about is taking two charges. And so we have charges and we have loops. So you can think about charge-charge statistics, charge-loop statistics, and loop-loop statistics. So first you could take two charges and you can ask, well, what happens if I exchange them? Well, because these charges are basically are descendants of excitations of my original bosonic model, they're always bosons. So this phase is just trivial. So there's nothing interesting here. But you could get you could also think about what happens if you take a charge and you braid it around a loop. And so in general, that will give you a non-trivial phase, which is the Aronoff-Bohm phase. It's given by Q times phi. So that's charges and loops. Then the last thing you could think about is loops with loops. Maybe there's something interesting, some interesting data here. So what you can ask, say I take some loop alpha and I braid it around another loop beta. So what I mean by this braiding is I take a small loop and say shoot it through a big loop and stretch it out and bring it back. Okay. So what is this? What is the statistical phase from this? So to answer that question, you can think about sort of a special case, which is you can say a loop is neutral if you can shrink it down to a point and annihilate it with a local gauge invariant operator. So that's we can define neutral loops by that definition. And you can ask what happens if you braid neutral loops. So you can argue on general grounds, I won't go through the argument, that if you have two neutral loops, the braiding has to be trivial. Because you can shrink them down to a point and annihilate them, the braiding basically has to be trivial. And once you have this result, then you can easily write down what happens in the general case. Because you can take a general loop, and you can argue that the statistics is given by q alpha times phi beta plus q beta times phi alpha. This first term comes from, so q alpha is the charge carried by alpha, and similarly, phi alpha is the flux carried by alpha. And this first term comes from braiding the charge on alpha around the flux of beta. And the second term comes from braiding the flux of alpha around the charge on beta.
So here, each loop are labeled by two vectors, one is the charge vector, another is the flux vector.
That's right. In the vacuum, you can label them that way in a very natural way. So if we summarize all of the data, we have this is the data we have. But you know, if you look at this data, you realize it's actually not very good data. And the reason is that we never talked about the Hamiltonian H. In fact, all of this data I could derive on general grounds. It's independent of what original Hamiltonian I started with that I gauged. So it doesn't tell me anything about the bulk structure. It's kind of only tells me about the symmetry group, really. So this is not interesting data. So, but it turns out you can get interesting data if you just think about slightly more complicated process. So what I want to think about is braiding one loop around another loop while they're both linked with a third loop. And this can give you something non-trivial. It doesn't have to be that simple formula, q alpha times phi beta and so on, because I can no longer shrink these loops down to a point. So this is going to be our interesting bulk data that we're going to probe the system with. So now the question becomes, how do we describe this bulk data? So, so how do we describe the braiding statistics of these loops? So you can argue actually rather easily that the braid group of these loops, which are linked to a third loop, is identical to the 2D braid group. So braiding loops linked with a base loop, we call this loop here the base loop. If I have multiple loops here that are linked with a base loop, the braid group of those loops is identical to the braid group in two dimensions. And in fact, the whole structure in two dimensions carries over. So in addition to braiding, we can think about fusing loops together and so on. So one way to describe the braiding data, probably the most general way, is to basically say for any given base loop, I have a 2D TQFT. I have a unitary tensor modular category for every base loop. So in other words, I would describe it by some data like this. This would be the R symbol, and I'd also have an F symbol, and I'd have quantum dimensions. And basically, just like the 2D story, the only difference is that they have this extra index C, which is that parameterizes the flux on the base loop. So that would be kind of the most general way of doing it, but it's kind of complicated. So we won't do it that way. So what I'm going to do here is I'm going to focus on the case where these loops have abelian statistics with each other. And when they have abelian statistics with each other, there's a much simpler data that can describe the same structure. Yeah.
In this dimensional data, we thought of there's a properties of the theory because I can define on a circle with a certain model.
Yeah, so you could think about, I don't know if that's what you're asking. You could take your 3D system. It's a related story. There's some slight technical differences, but you could take a 3D system where this direction is compact and put different amounts of flux here, and then you can have your flux. These would be your alphas and betas here, and you can, yeah. Yeah. That's right. It's the same idea. Yeah, so that's right. So there is some relation between the different TQFTs, which we've worked out in the abelian case, but I won't discuss it here. There are some constraints, in very interesting sort of 3D constraints. But that won't be so important for what I'm discussing today. So how do we describe the data? So we're going to focus on the abelian case. So in the abelian case, you can describe the data in more concrete terms. So basically what you do is, because once you think about the abelian case, it's enough to think about sort of the loops that carry unit gauge flux and ask about their braiding statistics. Because if you know what the braiding statistics of the unit gauge flux loops is, you can recreate the whole structure. So in particular, you can ask what happens if you take a unit type I gauge flux. So this carries flux 2 pi over n for the ith gauge field and 0 for everything else. And you braid it around unit type J gauge flux and then link to a unit type K gauge flux. And that can give you some phase. And actually, the interesting thing to think about, it turns out, is to ask not what happens if you braid it once, but what happens if I braid it n times. The reason is, this is sort of a technical thing, but the reason is that, remember, there are actually multiple types of vortex loops that differ by attaching charge. So in order to make this sort of a well-defined quantity, I have to braid it n times. Because, you know, if I attach some extra charges to these guys, it will, in general, that will change the phase of this braiding process. But if I braid n times, it's left invariant. So this definition here is well-defined. Any loop, you can choose any type I, type J loop, independent of how much charge is attached. Braid it n times, and you'll get the same number. So it turns out that this data basically captures all the statistical properties, with one exception, which is that in addition to thinking about braiding, we should also think about exchange. So if we have two loops that are the same, we need to ask what is their exchange statistics. And again, the right thing to do is think about exchanging n times. That gives you a nice number, which is we call theta ik. So now all our data is described by the mutual statistics, which is this thing between type I and type J, and the exchange statistics involving I of these loops. So this is all the data is described by these simple numbers, these simple phases.
How does that compare with what you get from group cohomology approach for the end? Because there you have to have four indices, right?
Right. So you can show, that there's a one-to-one correspondence for the abelian groups. In other words, every group cohomology model is uniquely distinguished by this data. There's a third piece of data which I haven't written down, which is very similar. Yeah, there is something. But I haven't talked about it because it has to do with a non-abelian case. So the loops can have non-abelian statistics also.
Everything is abelian.
No, but even if the gauge field is abelian, the loops can be non-abelian.
Oh, okay, so that's actually you cannot assume in general that the loops have a bigger space, even though all your data are going to the problem of scalability.
Right, you can, so this is a known thing. If you start with an abelian gauge field, and you, even in two dimensions, and you gauge it, you can get non-abelian statistics. And actually, we've discussed this case. I just, for the purpose of this presentation, I'm going to assume the loops are abelian, and I won't discuss this data. But this would be the last piece of data you would need.
We won't see here the more general phase going to some generic orca cycle.
That's right. So the story, we can include this, and it would just be one extra equation in what I'm writing down, but I just didn't want to bring it up. So I'm just assuming the loops are abelian. Okay. Okay, so that's our bulk data. What about our surface data? Well, on our surface, we have, remember, first thing we have is we have these anions, surface anions. So we can ask about their statistics. So remember, these anions are abelian by assumption. So their statistics is easy. We can define, there's some data that describes braiding. Their statistics is summarized, again, by thinking about the generating anions, the ones, so here, mu is supposed to be a generating anion of type mu. So it's basically an anion labeled by this vector, you know, 0, 0, 1, where this is in the muth entry. Okay, so we can ask what's the statistics of taking type mu around type nu, and that gives you some number, which we'll call phi mu nu. And you could also ask what's the exchange statistics of the type mu, and that gives you some number. Okay, so that's some data involving the anions. Of course, we also have this other excitation, which are these vortex lines. So the last piece of data is we can ask what's the statistics of the anions with respect to the vortex lines. So we could take an anion around a vortex line, for example, and ask about that. And it turns out that to get a number, what you have to do is braid it n times. If you braid n times, you can show that this statistical phase is always abelian, and it's some well-defined number, omega. The final piece of data is that you can ask sort of what happens if I take a type mu anion, I braid it around a type I vortex, then I braid it around a type J vortex, and then I do it in the reverse order. So this kind of measures some kind of commutator of these matrices. And that gives you one other piece of data. Now, I should say for experts, and I don't know if I'll have time to get to this, these two pieces of data are similar to the H2GA. There's another way of thinking about classifying how symmetries act on topological phases, which is in terms of something called H2GA. Maybe I'll get to that later, but this is just a simple way of encapsulating that information.
So the concern is that this I, the end of a vertex line, may correspond to non-abelian surface anion.
That's right. So actually, in general, the mu's are non-abelian. Even the mu's are non-abelian. They're abelian with each other,
yeah,
but they're non-abelian with the vortices. Yeah.
So once you have vortex and the vortex line, you may have a degeneracy.
That's right.
In general, those are not a fixed, really unitary matrix.
Actually, even the mu's by themselves have a non-trivial quantum dimension in general.
Okay.
The reason is that their statistics with each other is abelian, but
yeah,
they have a non-trivial quantum dimension. One way to see that is if your symmetry is, say, Z2 cross Z2, for example, your mu might transform kind of projectively under Z2 cross Z2, and then when you gauge it, it becomes a non-abelian particle.
In general, if you only braid once, you make a unitary matrix, which is not diagonal, or not the...
That's right.
It's not
that's
a
right.
Pure phase.
That's right.
So raise to the n times to make sure.
That's right.
Has a pure phase.
That's right. Okay. So, so there's one more quantity which we can define. Since I'm running low on time, I'll probably go quickly through it. So you can define it. This is not a new quantity. So actually, this quantity is completely determined by the previous quantities, but it's still useful to introduce it. So it's an integer tensor. It's labeled by two indices ik and a third index nu, and it's defined the unique solution to this equation. I probably don't have, let's see, should I go through this? 10 minutes. I probably won't go through this, but it has a physical meaning, which is related to something like this. So let's just summarize what we have here. So in the bulk, we have two pieces of data that we use to characterize our bulk system, and both of them have to do with basically the statistics of these loops linked to a third loop. So there are these two pieces of data. One involves exchange statistics and one involves mutual statistics. On the surface, we have a bunch of pieces of data which involve either the braiding statistics of the anions or the braiding statistics of the anions and the vortex lines. And finally, we have this last piece of data, X, which I just mentioned on the last slide. And it's really, I've written it on the bottom line here because it's not really independent. It's determined by the others. We just introduced it for convenience. So this is really the...
single index as a exchange statistic.
That's right. That's right. This is exchange statistics. This is also involves exchange statistics of loops with a base K. Okay, so these are our data. And so now the question is, what's the relationship between them? That's the bulk boundary correspondence. That's right. That's right. So we'll see that in the next slide. So this correspondence will only in some sense go one way. So actually, so maybe I'll show you. So the main result is this. This is some two equations which relate the bulk data to the boundary data. So everything on the right is boundary data. It's measurable in the boundary. And on the left, we have something that's measurable in the bulk. Now you can see exactly your point, which is that there's an asymmetry here, which is that if you know the boundary data, you can compute the bulk exactly. But if you know the bulk data, it only gives you some constraints on the boundary. Okay? So this is supposed to be analogous to that bulk boundary correspondence that I showed you for band insulators. There's one corollary of this, which is that if this bulk data is non-trivial, so if these guys are non-zero, then the surface must be protected. That is, if your surface is gap and symmetric, it must have fractional statistics. So how can you see that? Well, if these things are non-zero, then something on the right-hand side has to be non-zero. But for these things, you know, the only way that these quantities can be non-zero is if you have some anions, right? If you had no anions at all of these numbers are just zero, right? You don't have any anions to braid. X is zero, everything's zero. So if these things are non-zero, you have to have something on the surface. So it proves the surface is protected, but it does more than that. It gives you some relationship between the bulk and the surface data. Okay, so. I'm sorry?
There's nothing that I can cite that involves only endpoints of bulk.
Very good, right. Braiding vortex lines around each other is quite subtle and requires a really three-dimensional picture. Yeah, it's not something you can talk about just on the surface because they get entangled.
So on the right hand side, is it possible to have like some premodular theory with only a trivial fermion?
So I'm only talking about bosonic systems right now, so probably we won't be talking about that case, but you probably could generalize this to the fermionic case.
Even in bosonic system, the surface of some
I think it means what the surface is anomalous, not realizable. As the statistics you're describing are the boundary. It's anomalous in a sense. It's not realizable as a pure 2D system.
Just the statistics. If you don't worry about the symmetries, then it's always realizable. Because I can always, I'm assuming I can always gap the surface if I break the symmetry. So the bottom surface is always realizable.
So the statistical data is the statistical data you describe on the surface is always realizable.
Yes.
As a pure two-dimensional system.
Yes. So that's under the assumption, maybe we could prove it, that if you break the symmetry, you can gap the surface. I think that that's true because we know if we break the symmetry, we can continuously connect it to a trivial phase. So since you can, in the absence of any symmetries, there can't be any anomaly about this bottom surface. Yes. That's right. It doesn't. Okay. Very good question. So I probably won't have time to talk about it, but yes, you can prove these two equations. Maybe if we have time at the end, I could explain. You can prove that in any pure 2D system, there's kind of an analogous question. Suppose I just take a 2D system. You can still define this data. You can still ask if I braid an anion around a vortex, what do I get? Or if I take two anions, so you can still define this data, and you can prove you have to get zero here. You can prove it actually with some simple picture. So I think that's analogous to your question. So if you take a pure 2D system, this will be zero. Similarly, if I attach a 2D system to it, it doesn't change.
So the second question, which is a cousin, is reverse. Imagine you have some excitation on the boundary that can wander into the bulk.
Uh-huh.
You should have more trivial.
That's the charges. Those are the charges. So the charges are the only particle-like excitation that can wander in the bulk. And that charge only has non-trivial statistics with respect to vortex lines. as trivial statistics with respect to the surface particles, the anions. I don't know if that's what you're asking. Oh, well, remember that the way I've defined things, this, for example, this phi mu, this is the exchange statistics of the anions. I never talked about charges. None of this data describes charges. Say that again? Yeah, X is zero for the charge excitation. I would label charge excitation by something with all zeros because it carries zero anionic flux. Yeah.
Well, I think another, let me tell me what I'm going to say. You have only the surface data. You could not satisfy the consistency conditions for the 2 plus 1 dimensional bubble architecture. And the left hand side is the obstruction to that.
Yes. So in other words, you can show that a pure 2D system will always have these quantities vanishing. But on the surface of one of these 3D systems, these quantities don't vanish. Okay, so maybe I can just quickly, what I wanted to do was quickly derive one of these formulas for you, just show you how at least the philosophy of how you derive it. I'm going to focus on the second equation here. So how do we derive this connection between statistics in the bulk and these statistics on the boundary? So it's actually conceptually rather simple. So the idea is we start with some situation like this where we're braiding two loops around each other with a base loop. And we're going to use the following tool. Basically, the idea is we're going to take this process and we're going to deform it into a process involving the surface. And the idea is that statistical phases are invariant under, under basically deformations of my whatever I'm braiding, as long as those deformations are such that they never bring the two objects close together. So I'm allowed to basically deform the system as long as I don't bring two objects near one another, and it will never change the statistical phase. That's the basic tool I'm going to use. So first thing I do is I have this braiding process, and now the first thing I do is I stretch out those loops. And as I said, this deformation can't change the statistical phase, so I'll still get exactly the same statistical phase after I stretch the loops. Now what I do is I absorb the loops into the surface. Again, this is some local deformation, which is far away from the object it's being braided around. So it still will have the same statistical phase. So now I'm braiding these arches around each other while they're linked to this loop, and I have to get exactly the same statistical phase. Now I bring this loop K down to the surface. Shouldn't change the statistical phase. And now I absorb into the surface. Again, shouldn't change the statistical phase. Now I can unwind this bottom part, sort of disentangle it. And now, again, it shouldn't change the statistical phase. So now the statistical phase I need to compute is these two completely unlinked arches around one another. And if I can figure out what that phase is, that must be equal to the original phase in the 3D process. So we need to compute this phase, which I've just sort of isolated here. So how do we compute this phase? So the idea is the following. We split off an anion from this loop. Now, I didn't go through this in detail, but we want to split off an anion with a particular anionic flux, which is xik. K was the base loop. And here we split off an anion with a particular anionic flux, xjk. The reason we split off these particular types of anions is that you can show, once you split these two types of anions off, this arch, if I now shrink it down to the surface, I can shrink it down basically to just charges. It won't leave anything behind. So in some sense, what I've done here is split off all the non-trivial part of this arch.
So at some point, the case disappeared and I came back.
Yeah. Yeah, so that's the slide I skipped basically. So let me go back here. So the idea is the following. You know, at this point, if I fuse these two ends of this arch together, they will fuse to something trivial, right? Because remember, they came from this. So if I fuse these two together, I'll get something trivial. Okay? Sorry. And now it's still true. If I fuse these two together, I get something trivial. But now what happens is I wind this around. So that's that when I wind it around, now when I fuse these two together, I get something non-trivial. That has to do with the fact that these vortices are basically non-abelian particles. Their fusion channel changes when I braid something else around.
So the end points of the vortices.
Yes.
Change.
That's right. So now, when I fuse these two together, it actually gives me something non-trivial, which is exactly, if you compute what it is, it's this xik. So then what I do is I split off the xik and xjk, just split it off. So now what's left behind, I can fuse together, it's trivial. And now I can compute the statistical phase. There's sort of four contributions, braiding these arches around each other, I can write them here. I can braid the arches around each other, I can braid the two anions around each other, I can braid an anion around an arch around an anion. Four terms, you can show these are zero, and these you can recognize are gonna be related to our surface data, because this is braiding an anion around a vortex line. And so it actually gives you something like x times omega, and this also gives you some x times omega. So you get these two contributions, and those are exactly the two contributions in this first term. Yeah, I'm basically finished. So this last term here, I haven't explained where it comes from, but it has to do with the fact that, you know, I said you could break the process down into these sort of sub-processes. Well, these sub-processes don't quite commute with one another. So there's some commutators when you rearrange them, and that gives you this extra term. So the punchline is that the way we derive this formula is we just take our process in the bulk and we deform it to the surface and break it down into elementary processes, which are the way we defined our surface data. So that's how we get it. So maybe in just very quickly in the last 2 minutes, I would like to connect this with a related result involving cohomology, as it may connect with future talks. So, you know, so there's this beautiful work of Chen, Gu, Liu, and Wen, who basically constructed exactly soluble Hamiltonians for SPT phases. And what they showed is for every element of this cohomology group, H4GU1, they could construct an exactly soluble Hamiltonian, a corresponding Hamiltonian, H nu, which realizes an SPT phase with this symmetry group G. Okay, so it's this beautiful class of Hamiltonians, and there's some conjecture that maybe it realizes all the different SPT phases. So this would be kind of complete construction in some sense. Now you can ask a very concrete question. So these are called group cohomology models. So you can ask a concrete question, which is if I have a group cohomology model and has a gap symmetric surface, what are the properties of that surface? Like, what can I say about the surface? So this was discussed by this paper by Chen, Brunel, Vishwanath, and Fitkowski, and they describe the surface using slightly different data from the ones I described. They describe it in terms of R and F symbols involving the abelian anions, and then this something omega. This data is very similar to the data I used. It's just you can translate between the two of them. It's just a slightly different way of writing it. And then you can ask the question, so what's the relationship between this data and nu? Is there some constraint? And so they propose that there's this relationship. So this is the nu in the bulk gives you some constraint on the possible R's and F's on the surface. Or equivalently, if you know the R's and F's on the surface, you can compute nu on the bulk. I put a question mark here because I'm not sure if it's proven or if it's proposed, but anyway. Okay. Okay, so maybe I shouldn't. I just want to say that we can show that this is consistent with the correspondence we find here, because we can translate between our surface data and this surface data, our bulk data and this H4 bulk data, and the whole diagram you can show commutes. So maybe I'll finish there. Just to summarize, I've tried to tell you about a bulk boundary correspondence for 3D SPT phases. It relates bulk and surface properties. And importantly, these are local measurable quantities on the bulk and local measurable quantities on the surface. So it's somehow an analog of this bulk boundary correspondence for 2D band insulators, but in three dimensions. So I'll finish there. Sorry for going a little late.